Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Natalia, one of the hosts on the Literary Studies channel. Today my guest is Matthew Pauly, and we will be discussing his book Breaking the Tongue, Language, Education, and Power in Soviet Ukraine, 1923-1934. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So I know that you're currently in Odessa, Ukraine, on a Fulbright program. And would you tell us a little bit about your current research projects? What brought you to Ukraine?
So my current project is called City of Children. It's an investigation of the history of children's welfare in Odessa. I'm trying to do it over the 1917 divide. Investigating pre-revolutionary history of charity towards children, and then the Soviet concern for the large number of orphan and semi-orphan children that Soviet authorities confronted after the Civil War. The Soviet records are rich and vast, and so I find myself in this. I'm here for one semester only. Mm-hmm. I find myself concentrating very much on the Soviet period. This period I know well from having written this book that we're going to discuss. So the 1920s and 1930s is a period I feel I'm expert in, and I've been doing a great amount of work on that, but I started the project actually in St. Petersburg, Russia, working in the Russian Historical Archive there and looking at particular philanthropic institutions that were setting up children's shelters in Odessa at the turn of the century.
So currently you're in Odessa, and as a Fulbright scholar, you're affiliated with one of the institutions in Odessa. But what's your map of traveling across Ukraine?
So I'm really in Odessa. I'm trying to stay as much as I can in Odessa. I find that I have so much to go through in the Oblast Archive here. Although I had initial ambitions of going around Ukraine a bit more, as historians were sort of tethered to the archives, and that's how I feel in Odessa, and they're quite hospitable to me here too, so I'm able to work relatively efficiently. The building itself is not in great shape, but the administrators of the archive are wonderfully open and helpful people. So I've found that there's reason to stay and work here a fair amount. I flew into Odessa, and I've been up and back and forth to Kyiv. I'll go up again to give a talk to the Institute of History under the Academy of Sciences in a couple weeks now to discuss this book as well, the latter part of the book. I was invited to go up and give that talk, but beyond that trip to Kyiv, and then my family's going to come later, and my little girls see Ukraine for the first time, and we'll go back up to Kyiv and see Lviv as well. But beyond that, here I sit in Odessa trying to, I'm working in multiple places. I'm working in the main Oblast Archive, and then there's also a branch archive that looks that holds records specifically for the Communist Party, the former Communist Party archive, and work a lot in the main scientific library here as well. And I'm trying to see if I can get into the SBU archive to look at some files of educators who ran these children's buildings and children's villages in the 1920s and 30s, and were subsequently arrested. So we'll see if that comes to fruition. But that's one of my ambitions as well. So there's plenty to keep me busy here for a semester, is what I've found.
So before we discuss your book, Breaking the Tongue, would you tell us a little bit about your interest in Ukraine? Why Ukraine, and how did this interest originate? I know that you mentioned before we started the interview that you went to Ukraine as a high school student.
I did shortly after Chernobyl, so I think it must have been 87 or 88. It's the first time. I mean, it was a grand tour of the Soviet Union. I had a high school teacher that was fascinated with the Soviet Union, and it was a rare opportunity to come and see the Soviet Union. So we traveled around, but Kyiv was one of our stops, and I was immediately impressed by Kyiv and the greenness that is Kyiv, and was even more so at that time. It's just filled with parks, and it was relatively quiet compared to Moscow. So I don't know. I found Kyiv comforting in a way after the hustle and bustle of Moscow. But you know, it's always it's never an easy question. I have a long range explanation. I lived as a child in West Berlin and Vienna, both cities close to the Eastern Bloc, and I traveled a lot in the Eastern Bloc with my family, and was perplexed as a child why there was this difference between countries on either side of a border. And then I suppose Ukraine, the humorous answer I like to give is that when I was in high school, I had a test that was administered by my high school teacher, and one of the questions that was asked was, what countries emerged from the First World War with their independence? And I answered Ukraine, and he marked it as wrong. And so I had to go back and prove that indeed, for a short period of time, Ukraine was indeed independent and kept on fighting for its independence between 1917 to 1921. So Ukraine remained, it was a fascination for me then, and I guess the bug stuck with me my first year of graduate school. And a seminar in Ukrainian history, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do in graduate school, and this this seminar was eye-opening to me in terms of really giving me an opportunity to engage the complexity of Ukrainian history in a much deeper way than I ever had as an informal visitor to Ukraine, and through my sort of broad exposure as an undergraduate, I don't think I really understood what a complicated place Ukraine was, and you know, its complexity, I think, incites the curious, and I pursued that. I eventually ended up studying the Ukrainian language after taking turns in Russian and Polish. They didn't teach Ukrainian at my graduate institution at the time, so I went to Lviv and studied Ukrainian there, and then Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute, and became fascinated with the Ukrainian language as well, and beauty of this language. That's a multivalent response to the question.
Right. Well, thank you so much. That sounds fascinating. And is the Ukrainian history a part of your teaching currently?
It is. I mean, I fold Ukraine obviously into almost everything I teach if I get the chance. I have taught seminars, undergraduate seminars, on Ukrainian history, and then I teach our survey course on the history of the Second World War, and there's a huge emphasis on the war on the Eastern Front, and most specifically on Ukraine. So my students who know nothing, very few would know anything about Ukraine's participation in the war, and only slightly more know anything about the Soviet Union's broader participation in the war. So I bring it in where I can into larger classes to students who don't particularly enroll in the course to take a course in Eastern European history. They're going to get it through me, and most are genuinely pleased to learn something new. And then I teach History of Imperial Russia, and I teach, it's a survey course, so we do a fair amount on Ukraine there. And I also teach an upper-level senior seminar on nationalism and national identity in the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union. And obviously, we talk about Ukraine in that context too. And then I've been trying to do more, as this current project shows, with the history of childhood. So I teach a number of seminars related to the history of childhood. And we do a fair amount, I'd say, of history of childhood in the Soviet Union generally in that class.
So, moving towards your publication, Breaking the Tongue is a very impressive investigation that encompasses educational, political, social, and cultural phenomena that were shaping the formative years, not only of Soviet Ukraine, but the Soviet Union as well. And in your research, you carefully document what was going on in Ukraine in terms of language policy during the 1920s and 1930s. I would really like to start the discussion of this publication with the one of the concluding parts of this publication. That was Chapter 14, Biographical and Informational Sketches. And to say the least, this part resonates with terror. I don't want to sound overdramatic, but the information that you provide there is really terrifying. And here you compile biographical sketches of those who, this way or another, were somehow involved into this very controversial process of language policy that was introduced in Ukraine in the 1920s. So do you mind if I just reads just maybe just a few paragraphs from this part?
Sure, please.
Vasily Dohan was a leading pedagogue and researcher at the Scientific Pedagogical Academy of Sciences. He was arrested as an alleged member of the fictional Union for the Liberation of Ukraine and sentenced to a 3-year imprisonment outside the borders of Ukraine. His final fate is unknown. Volodymyr Durdukivsky was the director of the Shevchenko First Ukrainian Gymnasium in Kiev. He was arrested in 1929 as an alleged member of the fictional Union for the Liberation of Ukraine and sentenced to an 8-year imprisonment, was released early, but then was subsequently rearrested and executed in 1937. Mykola Khrylovy was a leading Soviet-Ukrainian writer and publicist. In 1933, he committed suicide during the midst of a new campaign of political and cultural repression in Ukraine. Volodymyr Zatonsky was a Communist Party figure. He was arrested in 1937 and later executed. And I just mentioned just a couple of those sketches that you included in this part. So how do we make sense out of all these stories? Would you introduce us to what was going on in Soviet Ukraine during the period that you covered in your research?
Sure. So, I'm glad you read those because they do in short form explain the conclusion, I suppose, to my story. There are many ways, an addendum to the book, right, designed to aid the reader in making sense of what I describe. Intentionally, I put them there intentionally to offer reference for the numerous names that readers confront as they read through the book. I think the larger story, I would not say my specialty is writing history of repression and terror, right? There's a certain cadre of historians, and that's all they do. But it is a necessary and definitely definitive part of the story that I tell, which is about a program that the Communist Party certainly supported, and I believe sincerely for a time, to promote national culture and national languages. But they didn't have the political cadres that didn't have large numbers of committed Ukrainian speakers in the Communist Party who could promote the Ukrainian language throughout the Republic. And so they in many ways were forced to rely on non-party educators and members of the national intelligentsia, some of whom had been quite opposed to Bolshevik rule, although by and large, the vast majority of them were decidedly left and shared some of the aspirations of the communist state in broad form. So the argument that I make in the book is that the Communist Party relied on these educators out of necessity, although many of these educators shared their own private suspicions about communist power or the role of the party in Soviet Ukrainian life. They were nevertheless committed to this particular program and didn't see what the future for this program would hold, right? So they worked, I believe, quite genuinely and energetically to fulfill the program that they were asked to carry out because they believed in it. They had the skills to accomplish a transformation of linguistic culture in Ukraine. But the party's trust in these non-party educators and intellectuals was limited. It's a highly detailed book, right, mm-hmm. where I try to explain some of the divisions that occur. But I guess I would say the Communist Party was only willing to let them go so far, right? And they didn't fully allow these teachers and educators to pursue each of their ambitions. And there came a point in time where the party begins to worry about what is actually being taught specifically in the classroom, right? So the book focuses on primary schools, that is elementary schools, and what is going on in these elementary schools. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that although this was certainly an important policy, that is the transformation of linguistic culture and the promotion of non-Russian languages and non-Russian cultures, it was very much decentralized. So in spite of its political importance, the decisions about how this policy was going to be implemented were given to local education officials and then below them teachers and members of the Ukrainian national intelligentsia. So the program is handed over in many ways in a daily sort of sense to people that didn't enjoy the full trust of the party, and because of its decentralized nature, the party wasn't entirely sure what was happening in the classroom, or what was resulting from this decision to push Ukrainian culture, specifically in the Soviet Ukrainian Republic.
So the official term for this process, just to clarify for our audience, is Ukrainization.
Yes.
And And so my question is about the origins of this process, because on the one hand, it may sound to some quite paradoxical that we speaking about Ukraine as a country, either as a part of the USSR or just as a country itself. But still, we're talking about the introduction of the Ukrainian language into this country. So why was it necessary to introduce the Ukrainian language in Ukraine?
Right, well, they're not really introducing the Ukrainian language, right? The Ukrainian language, obviously, it exists, but it's being spoken primarily by those Ukrainians who live outside the main cities of Ukraine, not exclusively, but by and large, that's where the Ukrainian-speaking population is. And so Ukrainian language is fully, in my view, certainly now and even more so, one could argue, then in the vast majority of the countryside, a vivid and widely used language. The challenge comes, I think, from a number of reasons, right? So the first one and the most elementary of them is that there is a Ukrainian national revolution. There are successive attempts by Ukrainian leaders to create an independent Ukrainian state. It's a highly complicated history, the one that I think even specialists like myself get confused by the number of iterations of Ukrainian state and its fortunes. But nevertheless, it wasn't easy for the Red Army and for pro-Soviet Ukrainians or pro-Soviet residents of the provinces of the Russian Empire that came to constitute Ukraine. It wasn't easy for them to secure a firm political hold on Ukraine. So in one, at one level, this policy of Ukrainianization is a gesture towards a reality that the Bolsheviks and the Communist Party face. That is, that there is an increasing tendency to identify oneself in national terms. The national movement wasn't strong enough to secure Ukrainian independence permanently, but it's strong enough to resist or at least impede repeated attempts to bring Ukraine into what eventually becomes the Soviet Union. But the larger, so that's the sort of the, I suppose, most elementary explanation. The larger concern is really a recognition that the country is nearly 80% ethnically Ukrainian. By and large, this population speaks Ukrainian. And if they're going to create a modern and industrialized portion of the Soviet Union in Ukraine or space of the Soviet Union in Ukraine, then they need to make sure that the labor force that is coming into the cities is able to adapt and readily operate within the environment of those cities. So it calls for most pointedly a transformation of the urban space, the creation of a Ukrainian-speaking urban space to in a way facilitate the in-migration of Ukrainian peasants into the city, were viewed as a necessary part of a labor force that is only going to grow over the course of time in industrial spaces. So it's about transformation of the urban space. It's also about sort of the creation of a new modern Ukrainian national culture that is not rooted in the countryside. So everything has to change within the cities, and Ukrainianness or Ukrainian culture has to become associated really with the certainly the modernizing and industrializing aspirations of the Communist Party.
So what contributed to this division between the Ukrainian-speaking countryside and Russian-speaking city? What contributed to this difference in terms of population, who would choose this or that this or that language? Is this correct to assume that this Ukrainization policy was a part of what was going on under the Russian Empire. All the decrees and all the regulations which were introduced by the Russian Empire to ban the Ukrainian language. We know the Ems Decree, 1876, and then again there was some kind of going back to that policy by Stolypin's endeavors, again, to ban the Ukrainian language and to promote the Russian language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so you're describing sort of anti-Ukrainian laws that were enacted by successive czars and their servitors, which ensured that the language of culture, the language of the published word, by and large, and for that matter, the language of the city and language of education was Russian. Right? There was generally speaking, there was very little possibility of gaining an education within the Russian Empire in the Ukrainian language, and certainly you're not going to get it if you came to the city seeking it. So, yeah, there are all sorts of restrictions on the use of Ukrainian, the view, of course, for Russian imperial authorities, and this had broad sympathy in cities within Ukraine, was that Ukrainian wasn't a real language, that it was a dialect of the Russian language, and that if one was going to become, if that was your aspiration as a recent migrant to the city in Imperial Russia in the 19th century, for example, you're going to become cultured, then you're going to switch over to the use of Russian. So, you know, this book is in part also, I suppose, an examination of what I feel. This has been universally true for leaders of the Communist Party, but there was a logic among some that they were writing a historical wrong, right? It's complicated, I think, to figure out truly what the intentions of the party leadership as a whole were. But in general, I try to make the argument that, which isn't novel, it's been made by historians before me, that there, even among the leadership in Moscow, there was a committed attempt to support Ukrainization and to support non-Russian cultures generally, and partly it's this notion that they were doing better than Russian imperial authorities had done before them, right? That the Ukrainian nation had suffered under Russian imperial authority, and they were correcting that past. But with a specific agenda in mind, that is, again, to make use of the fodder at their disposal, that is, a labor force or potential labor force that spoke overwhelmingly Ukrainian in the borders of the Soviet Ukrainian Republic.
Yeah, like you mentioned, it's quite unclear what were the intentions, real intentions, for this process. For example, the showcase intent was probably to promote the Ukrainian language and Ukrainian culture. However, when it comes down to what groups were subjected to this process, this clarity and this certainty becomes somewhat blurry. And you mentioned the change in the process overall when Stalin was gaining power in the Soviet Union, and the overall tone toward the Ukrainization changed, because I guess the question shifted to whether the Russian community could be subjected to the Ukrainization. Is that somehow
Right, the rhetoric moves to, so, and you say at the outset, right, Ukrainianization never technically ends, but in my view, linguistic Ukrainianization is robbed of any vigor, really, at an earlier date than I think other historians have talked about. So I just focus in particular on this trial of members of the Ukrainian intellectual elite, including leading pedagogues and people like Dodokivsky, very well-known primary school teachers, right, in what was called the Union for the Liberation of Ukraine, Spilka Vyzvolenia Ukraine. So I think things change fundamentally there, because these, all the people that are being placed on trial, are committed Ukrainizers, and people, teachers, particularly teachers sitting in provincial cities or towns, who read of these trials, or of this particular trial and of this particular group that didn't really exist, but was created to send a particular message, that is, be careful just how far you push Ukrainization, or remember that Ukrainization is always under the party's leadership, and decisions don't rest with you. So in my view, this particular trial had a pedagogical intent of its own, and teachers who, some of whom certainly in provincial cities, who were resisting the transfer to Ukrainian language instruction, decided that it wasn't worth doing. The penalty for being too energetic in one's embrace of Ukrainianization and not knowing what the limits were, was high, right? The penalty for embracing it too zealously was high, whereas the penalty for not doing anything at all really wasn't significant. So there are all sorts of exhortations for teachers to first learn Ukrainian if they didn't know it already and they were teaching in Ukrainian school, and to improve their knowledge, and teachers are told to do this. They're given examinations on occasion of their Ukrainian language knowledge, and also their knowledge of what was broadly called Ukrainian studies, so, which meant not a concern for, you know, Ukrainian folklore or culture, but knowledge of new progressive and modern Ukrainian Soviet literature. That demonstrate all these things, but they could repeatedly fail the exam without considerable consequence, and they also often were able to postpone these sorts of exams. So here in Odessa, where I am now, I wrote a chapter in the book on Odessa because I found Odessa a fascinating place. In the Central Archives, there was a lot of information about resistance to Ukrainization in southern Ukraine, centered around Odessa. And for the first time, I found in Odessa examples of these tests that teachers had to take to demonstrate the Ukrainian language knowledge. And the tests, I assume, were supposed to be marked on basis of grammar and things along these lines, but they also had a political intent. So the number of the questions that they were asked were about their understanding of the political meaning of Ukrainianization. Did they understand, as teachers in Soviet schools, why Ukrainianization was necessary? And, you know, it's hard to judge as a historian, but those teachers who conceded that it was foolish to teach in Russian to Ukrainian-speaking children often got high marks on their samples of written work. So, anyhow, teachers recognized that after 1930, even if the policy continued, there's no point in pushing it too hard, that they could risk definite penalty by doing so, right? They could be dismissed, they could be arrested, mm-hmm. and they could ultimately be exiled or executed for alleged participation in Ukrainian nationalist activity. So the Communist Party was worried that that Ukrainianization was leading to a tick up in an embrace of separatist Ukrainian nationalism in the schools.
Yeah, I found that aspect about nationalism is quite interesting in this research. I believe this a concept of nationalism would be different in the context of the Ukraine of the 1920s and 1930s. If compared to the context of, for example, 2010 or 2016, could you elaborate a little bit on this concept of nationalism under the Ukrainization or under the Soviet Union?
So, what did nationalism mean to
right.
the Soviets, or what? I mean, I guess I'd say this that. National identification is good, right? That the Soviets generally believed that that you had to pass through a stage of national identification before and that one had to become an informed modern citizen, and the only way to do that was through a language that you understood, which also called for an embrace of the national language, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what you couldn't do was argue, for example, the Ukrainian was only for ethnic Ukrainians, which would be, I suppose, the most the darkest thing of all. But or arguing that that Ukraine could pursue a somewhat independent path towards socialism, independent from Moscow's leadership. And there were certainly voices along these lines, not arguing for a break necessarily from the Soviet Union, but arguing there are distinctive things in Ukraine and distinctive challenges that the people as a whole in Ukraine, whether they were ethnically Ukrainian or not, faced that called for some allowance of a decentralization of political power, right, and some amount of decision making to be invested in the Republican leadership of Soviet Ukraine and of the Ukrainian branch of the Communist Party. But I mean, there's the constant ghost, I'd say, in this story that I tell of the Ukrainian national or the Ukrainian revolution, right? So the people that are ultimately put on trial for this Union for Liberation of Ukraine, many of them had some affiliation with the Ukrainian People's Republic. It's one of these short-lived Ukrainian independent states. And they're accused of commemorating one of the leaders of that state, Simon Pedlora, accused of collecting money in his honor after his death. The term that is often applied to those that the Soviet Communist Party accused of Ukrainian nationalism is Petlorist, right? So mm-hmm. it's a direct invocation of this very contested time between 1917 to 1921. So there's they have something tangible that they can point to in terms of their understanding of what nationalism is. The nationalism is that thing that fought against us in the Civil War, and I think there is a perpetual anxiety of that somehow reanimating itself. Now, I should say that I found, you know, if you read some of the private and some of these diaries have been published of those who were accused of being members of the Union for Liberation of Ukraine, the diary of its alleged leader, Serhiy Efremov, has been published, and it reveals certainly disenchantment with Soviet power, but it doesn't reveal anything along the lines of a nationalist conspiracy designed to break away Ukraine from the Soviet Union. So, and there's a tension, and I think the in many ways it's a contradictory policy that is difficult to describe in a 2-minute answer, right? But it takes a 400-page book to describe about this intention to create a Ukrainian-inflected modern industrial space, but an unwillingness to trust others to build that state in the party's name, even though the party was forced by circumstance to rely on such individuals for a time. What the limits of Ukrainian national culture are in the 20s, I'd say, are not known. Involved in the policy, and I guess I'd certainly like to emphasize, if I could, in my comments now, that I really, if you take the time as I did to read through all these files, it's difficult to come away with the conclusion that Ukrainianization was somehow false, right? Mm-hmm. Or artificial. Mm-hmm. Because if it was, immense amount of people spent an immense amount of time dedicating themselves to this effort, and for a time they're given the space to do so.
So, was this process successful in your opinion?
Was it successful?
Yes.
So I would say, I suppose it depends on what we define success as being. Obviously, it wasn't successful by the ambitions of those who were most committed to Ukrainianization, right? Everyone who is intimately tied with the program or at least most who are intimately tied with the program of Ukrainianization meet a pretty bad fate, right? As a graduate student, how I got involved in this project was really as a student of nationalism, not as a student of education, but I became aware, right, that all the commissars of education, or many of them, had become victims of political repression as a result of their involvement, partly, in Ukrainianization. So for these people, obviously, Ukrainianization isn't successful, right? I suppose as I understand Ukrainianization as and what it came to be over the course of the 1920s, I don't think one can argue that it's fulfilled in any measure of the word. That being said, certainly there's a school of historians that argue, and I don't entirely disagree with them, that. And the Soviets did aid in the creation of something called Ukrainian national identity and Ukrainian national space. I still believe that if we're talking about the year 1991, certainly that's true, right? When the over 80% of the population votes for Ukrainian independence, and people recognize what the territory of Ukraine is. Now, that is obviously in dispute as a result of the war that is going on in southeastern Ukraine. But all the pre-conflict, pre-2014 data suggests there was a firm commitment to the idea of Ukrainian territorial integrity, even in southeastern Ukraine. So it's gotten exceedingly complicated, I think. It's not to deny that there isn't genuine separatist sentiment among some of the people fighting in southeastern Ukraine, but I think it's taken external factors to really question the notion of what is the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and partly, that's I suppose related to this study. I mean, I chose to dedicate a chapter to Odessa because Odessa is, I argue that it's a multi-ethnic space in which Ukrainianness came to be accepted by a portion of the population, and I have examples of Russian-speaking parents petitioning for the local education authorities to create Ukrainian schools because they see knowledge of Ukrainian as a quality or as a skill that they believe their children need to have in the future Soviet Ukraine. So that's to me also an expression of where potentially this policy could have gone. But I also talk in the last chapter a fair amount about the Donbas, and that is the area where the war is going on right now in southeastern Ukraine. It's not an easy road for the Ukrainianizers there as well, but there is a commitment on the part of those invested in the policy of Ukrainization to also promote Ukrainian language in industrial and urban spaces in southeastern Ukraine. The argument's easier to make, obviously, when you go outside the cities again, but they're committed to trying to transform those spaces in southeastern Ukraine. So,
Sorry.
I don't know. I'd say it's not successful in terms of the understanding of the original architects of the policy and those entrusted with implementing the policy. But they're the fact that Ukrainian language schools never entirely disappear, and Ukrainian national culture, even though it's marginalized to specific spaces, Ukrainian national culture continues to be supported at some level by the state. I suppose is in a way a legacy of this policy, but I think I'm decidedly pessimistic by the end of the book, and in my tone. I mean, the future might have been different.
Well, just one more question about your research. You also extensively comment on the children's involvement into this policy. Could you tell us just a little bit about that aspect of this process?
Yeah, so I mean, children's perspective is always difficult to get at. I struggle as a sort of burgeoning historian of childhood to talk about the children's perspective. In many ways, we see their role through the lens of institutions such as schools. So I focus on children quite obviously because they are at the center of my study in terms of being the objects that are begging for transformation, right? So they're in these Ukrainian language schools as they're converting to full-scale Ukrainian language in instruction, and I think my concern for children happens well. I mean, it's easy to explain for anybody writing a history of schools, but I try to make the argument that there's such a penalty against the notion of forced Ukrainianization, right? There's a stricture against this. Certainly, you couldn't force ethnic Russians to speak Ukrainian. One of the aims of, or one of the defining aspects of Ukrainization was a sort of sorting out of people by national affiliation. So I think Ukrainians were supposed to go to Ukrainian schools, ethnic Russians were supposed to go to Russian schools. It was never that perfect, but that's how it was imagined. National minorities were supposed to go to schools that taught in their language what the state thought should be their language of instruction. But it became decidedly tricky when one was dealing with what to do with people who were ethnically Ukrainian but were members of the industrial working class or the proletariat, right, and who spoke Russian, and they'd been there for a generation, and they lived in a Russian-speaking city in Ukraine for some time, or their family before them, and they spoke Russian. So what to do about them if they are identified as ethnically Ukrainian, but speakers of Russian? And I make the argument in the book that one of the ways to go around the prohibition against forced Ukrainization was to Ukrainize to reorient the language, the spoken language of their children in the schools. So that was one way I suppose the party could never forfeit the notion that the industrial labor class or the proletariat had to speak Ukrainian. If it didn't, then what was the whole point of the policy? Laborers had, it was imagined, in the end result of Ukrainization would be in industrial areas and urban areas, people would be speaking Ukrainian. And Mykola Skripnik, the last commissar of education during my period of study, comes up with this tactic of essentially doing a run around the parents. And if you identified as ethnically Ukrainian, you were supposed to overcome the state's presumption that your child attend a Ukrainian school. So there's a focus on children in that respect. And then a larger argument is that, children become the objects of political contestation for the state, for the Communist Party, and for Ukrainizers, right? So there is a concern about what actual lessons children are receiving in Ukrainian language schools. The party doesn't entirely know, and they're worried. There's a hope that the children can right the wrongs of the Ukrainian national intelligentsia, right? But there's also a suspicion that they've become victims of their influence. And I think this occasions the script, as I put it, of repression in Ukraine. So the people that are targeted in this Union for Liberation of Ukraine trial are people who had direct responsibility over the cultivation and education of children. And I think for that reason, they become highly vulnerable to the suspicions of the Communist Party, and most certainly to the suspicions of the State Security Service or the GPU.
Well, could we say that this kind of policy, either Ukrainization or Russification, can be quite traumatizing for children in particular? Because on the one hand, they are exposed to different languages. However, on the other hand, there are some other consequences, cultural and even mental, that are not that positive. So would you comment on the traumatizing probably effects of this kind of enforcement?
Yeah, I mean, that's difficult to uncover from the historical record, mm-hmm. right? It's certainly from the archival record, mm-hmm. what sort of, I think it's certainly valid and legitimate question. What are you supposed to think if you're going from, if you live in a city like Odessa and you live in a Russian-speaking home, but you're ethnically Ukrainian, now you're being told to go to Ukrainian school where right. Ukrainian is the predominant language of instruction, and your family doesn't speak that language at home and may, in fact, not want you to go to such a school, but the state is placing immense pressure for you to attend such a school. So I don't know. I can't give you a neat answer from the perspective of the child. All I can tell you is what teachers are recorded to have said according to educational inspectors. And I mean, teachers resisted this as well, and some complain that this is causing confusion in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Children don't know what to make of it. Mm-hmm. But there also is evidence that children, you know, adjust relatively quickly if given the time, I suppose, and also the commitment and energy of teachers who are willing to do this. I mean, but it also is. I mean, one of the other streams of the book, I talk a lot about sort of the Ukrainianization element, and I've been asked to speak about it a fair amount here in Ukraine as well too. But there's another strand to the book that is this implementation of quite progressive pedagogy. One of the things I found when I started doing the research is quite obviously Ukrainianization isn't the only thing that people are concerned about when they're concerned about schooling in this period. So teachers being asked to really radically transform the way they teach in the classroom, not teach according to textbooks, create their own modules for learning, and to rely also on initiative from children. And that also creates confusion as well. Some children conceivably responded quite well. Of course, that was the aim of progressive pedagogy. But I think I say at several points in the book that teachers and children, I think, should be included as well. Didn't know what to make of what they were being asked to do. So that doesn't... preclude the reality, certainly, that the archival record demonstrates that children did adjust, and that there was an embrace by children, teachers, and parents of the transformation of the classroom to Ukrainian language instruction. But certainly a portion of them had to be confused and as to what went on in the minds of any individual child, that's harder to say.
So do you believe that those who advocated for the Ukrainization and for the progressive pedagogy really had some vision of some final results of these processes? Or they just had some idea what could be done in order to have this transition from the countryside to the urban life, and that's what they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think most certainly when one talks, so the two things are separate, but they're also connected: progressive pedagogy and Ukrainian language instruction or national language instruction. I think Ukrainization is easier to say that they had, that there was a committed group of both teachers and then above them, inspectors of education, local sections of education, and then above them, people defining the policy in the Republican capital of Kharkiv, who had a dream of the realization of this idea. I don't think that's much in dispute. What was going to be realized by progressive pedagogy is harder to say. I mean, it was a stream of teaching that had been certainly advocated by those outside the Soviet Union, advocated well before the creation of the Soviet Union, but it's still relatively new. And the thought was that if you give teachers flexibility and you give students flexibility to learn what they want to learn in the, I suppose, or more importantly, in the way they want to learn, then they're going to achieve a better learning outcome. By and large, I think teachers were simply not trained to do this. They didn't have the education to sort of create their own lessons plans, and they're given very little direction and instruction. The whole thing is very, as they make the claim repeated, the whole thing is very decentralized, and that applies to both the way children were taught and what language they were taught, right? So the creation of lesson plans is left open, really, to individual teachers, but then just above them, local education sections, and then and the manner in which Ukrainianization was to be achieved is also very much left on the local level. So one of the perplexing things that I found is, mm-hmm. you know, there's an absence of trained Ukrainian speakers in certain parts of Ukraine and certainly in urban spaces. And one would think that if the center, in this sense, the center, I mean, Kharkiv, the Republican capital, that is, if the leaders of Soviet Ukraine were truly committed to carrying out the policy of Ukrainization to the end, that there would be some coordination of the teacher labor force, right? So that if there's a surplus of Ukrainian language teachers, say, in the countryside around Kyiv or Cherkasy, then that then it will be transferred to places where skilled Ukrainian language teachers were needed. And that didn't happen. Local education sections in the Donbass area, for example, had to petition individually for teachers to come and negotiate individually with teachers and sometimes with local education sections, but the whole thing's not coordinated from the center. While I don't question the intent to achieve Ukrainianization, there's a certain absurdity to the way in which it was carried out.
So, your current project is dealing with children as well, is that correct?
Yes.
And it's about the Odessa region as well.
Yeah, so I wrote this one chapter in the book on Odessa, and my first time in Odessa, I couldn't get in the Oblast Archive. This was many years ago. As I said, the Oblast Archive here is a wonderfully supportive place, but they don't have a lot of room mm-hmm. For readers, and that remains true to this day. So although eventually I was given permission to begin work there, and I've been very grateful for the support I've received since. The first time I was here, I couldn't get in, so I contacted the university here, or the university that I'm now affiliated with, and a member of the faculty took me on a sort of tour of Odessa with a insight into the history of education, and he took me out to the site of the first children's village named after the Comintern that was established in 1920 and embraced sometimes in excess of 2,000 children, many of whom were orphaned, but not exclusively. There were children who had one surviving parent, and there were also cases of children attending educational institutions in this children's village. It was a conglomeration of different children's shelters that were all brought together on the grounds of the former cadet academy. I visited this place. I had never heard of it before. It was new to me, and then became aware of just how amazingly famous this place was, and they were practicing the sort of same progressive pedagogy, but they had greater freedom, I suppose, to do it because there's by and large the absence of parental, from their perspective, the absence of parental interference in terms of what was being attempted in these educational institutions. And it has some overlap with what I did before. I mean, children mm-hmm. were again divided by nationality. So there were, for these children who lived permanently on the grounds of this children's village, they were housed in different buildings according to their nationality. So there was a Polish building, there was a Ukrainian building, and so on. Anyhow, once I began starting working on this project, I became aware of the immense amount of institutions like this dedicated to the care of children, and I also became aware of a much deeper history that stretched back before the revolution. So the problem of street children has been a persistent one in Odessa, and it was only exacerbated by the First World War and the Civil War and then the famine that followed, and Soviet authorities had to confront that challenge. What is amazing, I think, is that that it has this larger history, right? And one of the things I'm trying to investigate is how much Soviet authorities are pulling on a previous experience, a late imperial experience of caring for such vulnerable children. But I think the other thing is that, you know, it becomes a point of pride. The problem never goes away, and that's what I've encountered in files that I'm examining right now. So it's not just the early 20s, it persists well into the 30s. And the same issues seem to come up again and again in terms of the absence of funding, buildings falling down, children not having, as you would expect, enough food, clothing, linens, and things like that. But it's still, particularly this one children's village or children's city, sometimes the Ukrainian word is mistechko, Russian word korodok, it becomes a place of pedagogical innovation and pride for local Odessan educational authorities. So I just encountered last week documents from InTourist, right, the official Soviet tourist agency, that they're recounting the possibility of a visit by American and Spanish tourists to Odessa, and the one thing above all that they have to see is this children's village. So it's a project that runs parallel to my previous work on the history of schooling in Ukraine, but one that, you know, one never escapes. I think when one works in this area, the question of national identity and certainly Ukrainianization again pops up in these documents, but that's not my main intent. My main intent is really to examine, you know, what the Soviets were doing with this children's population that was largely at their disposal to mold, right? And I don't mean that in a cynical way, but that was the reality. They had a very large children's population, and it's in spaces such as this that they're trying to create skilled, informed, and future leaders of Soviet Ukraine and the Soviet Union more broadly. But it has a connection, I think, to imperial past that is preference for dealing with such vulnerable populations in an institutional manner, right? Housing them in rather large institutional settings. Also recognizing that this is sort of a public security risk, right? Many of these children live life on the streets and engaged in petty thievery, and Soviet authorities, like their imperial predecessors, were worried about this, and they're worried generally about, you know, what do foreign visitors think if they come and see such ragamuffins on the street, right? So the instinct is to put them in a controlled setting and to really make something of their lives and to showcase what they're doing to foreign visitors that then come.
Well, sounds very intriguing. Good luck on your current project.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Matt. Thank you for this fascinating discussion of your book.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome the opportunity.